Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guest is Professor Michael Parkinson. Michael is now Associate Pro Vice Chancellor for Civic Engagement at the University of Liverpool, but everyone will know Michael is an eminent scholar and advocate for cities. He's been studying cities in the UK and across the globe for more than 40 years. So what he doesn't know about cities isn't worth knowing. And actually, on a personal note, Michael is a significant reason why I got into cities and the urban policy space, having read your much of the work that you were doing around the mid and mid-late 80s. That was an inspiration to me to get into this sort of space. So it's a particular pleasure to say, Michael, welcome to City Talks.
Andrew, marvellous. Well, I didn't realise that, and I'm very pleased that you took my advice and got into it, and I'm very pleased to be here today. So, wonderful. Looking forward to it.
And we're going to talk about and focus on your latest book, which is Liverpool Beyond the Brink, and it was published earlier on in 2019, and it's the follow-up to a book that you published in 1985, which was entitled Liverpool on the Brink. And I think that's where I would like us to start, is to talk really about the history and the chronology of Liverpool, yes, where we are today, but actually where we were before. So just take us back to Liverpool on the Brink and before, and what's Liverpool been like since the 70s? Remind us of that.
I think we should start with that. Liverpool was the second city of the greatest empire the world had ever seen. The port made it. It stumbled in the 30s, it pretty much collapsed in the 70s, and you have no idea what Liverpool was like in the 1980s, economically, politically, psychologically, physically. I mean, it was absolutely on its knees. It was a pariah as far as government was concerned. It had lost people, lost jobs, lost hope, lost confidence, lost its way. And I think it's a really extraordinary story about the renaissance of the city, which is not complete in any sense, but is well on its way. And I'm very interested, partly because I live there, I work there, I love it, on trying to tell that tale of how do we get from there, and where was that, to here, and where is that?
Yeah.
And capturing that growth, success, but also uncertainty.
Yeah. You know?
That's so, I think this is the really important way of looking at the way this city and our big cities have changed,
yeah,
what they have achieved, and what the risks might be.
Yeah, and I've heard you say elsewhere, you, having written On the Brink in 1985, you vowed never to write another piece about Liverpool until you felt like there was something good to be said, and you know, there was some good news and some positivity to espouse. So I suppose that's partly why now is the time, I suppose, to come back and mark the card of Liverpool as we get, you know, towards 2020.
Absolutely. Having written a story about the collapse, I didn't want to continue writing about that. I didn't think I could make my career about that. And living there, I just needed to write about other places. And lots of people have said over 30 years, you must update it. It wasn't until the chief executive then of the city 18 months ago said, Michael, the story now has to be told. You are the person to tell it. You know it. You've lived here. You've observed it. And I thought, it is the time. I now know it's a good news story, not a bad news story. So I can go on public platforms and talk about the place without apology, without guilt, without fear,
yeah,
with some optimism and confidence.
Yeah, no, it definitely comes through in the book, the considered, careful, kind of honest appraisal, and the way that you just gently introduce some of the issues that need to be discussed, I think is, you can feel, I can feel that very clearly when you're reading it. Let's go back to the book, and you start off, well, actually, say a little bit about, you know, Liverpool as an imperial city, because that's an kind of framing point that you use to both express and talk about Liverpool as is, and then talk about it today as a post-imperial city. So just say what you mean by that, and how did that colour Liverpool's expansion and success?
It was a global city before the term global was invented. It was outward facing, it was connected, it traded in ideas and people and market and products. It was not an English city, it was an immigrant city, it was a Celtic city. We're not English, we're Scousers. And so it was a big place, and you realized it was a big place, not a town which had got overgrown.
Mm.
And it seemed to me, in its downfall, that's what it had lost. It stopped being an outward-facing, external, international city and became totally wrapped up in its internal failings and focused only on those. And I think what I've said is it's a post-imperial city. It'll never be an imperial city again, nor should it be, because it was built on slavery. There were more paupers than millionaires. Mm. It was not a place that you want to return to. What I try to say in the book is it should go back to its roots in the sense of being a global city, an outward-facing, expansionist, confident, connected, ambitious place. And I think that's part of this book is about the psychology and culture of the city. And mm. I think that's really what I think we have now got, a changed perception of ourself, of the role in the world, and an understanding that we were once like that, and we can be that again.
Yeah.
So that's, for me,
yeah.
one of the key messages.
And there's a lovely quote, well, you quote other, but in your sense in the book, saying, you know, we're not English, we're Scousers.
Absolutely.
As, you know, and there's something to that, and to the psychology, to the brand, to the understanding, to the view of the world.
Absolutely. And I say at the end, we have to think more clearly about our international role, our international aspirations, partly for economic reasons, because Brexit or not Brexit, we are going to have to find new markets and new places. Mm. And I think returning that self, you know, what we once were, I think would be a very helpful guide. We don't do enough of it, we're turning to it. So it seems to me as we look forward rather than look back, that's the way in which we should look.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk through the chronology of it. In the book, you have four sections, or five sections, I suppose, but certainly four sections where you begin to tell the story about where we find Liverpool and the actors and the decisions and the strategies and the policy. So you start off in 1973, and the first period is 73 to 88. And just remind us what was Liverpool like politically, economically, socially in that period?
Yes, I call that the kind of decline of empire, the decade of paralysis, the decade of coalition, the decade of conflict. The city had huge economic problems, primarily because of the impact of the oil-based recession in 73. Entering Europe had a very damaging effect upon the port, as it were, and underlined the dramatic change was taking place in its economy. What was particular about Liverpool was its inability to cope with that economic collapse. And that's a great deal to do with its politics, which has a great deal to do with its history, social, economic, and cultural makeup. Never been a Labour city, despite the fact being, you know, a big city, last big city in this country to go Labour. Controlled by the Conservatives, primarily because of working class Protestantism and the division over Irish immigration, all that, you know. We had sectarian politics really up until the late 60s, early 70s. And it seemed to me that what we had in this period was the shift from sectarian politics to class-based politics, the shift from Conservative to Labour, but it was broken by the emergence of this Liberal Party, which sprang from nowhere, took the biggest seats on the council, but never had a majority. So the time when you had a decade of economic collapse, you had profound political instability and uncertainty, and the city was unable really to come to terms with that.
Mm.
That allowed the entry of the militant tendency, which although small, took over the Labour Party, pushed it to the left, and decided it would use Liverpool as a wedge against capitalism, conservatism, and Thatcherism.
Mm.
So this city became the kind of the victim of all these tremendous changes. And in the 80s, in I wrote the book, and therefore, personally, it was an exciting time.
Mm.
I was the scribe, I was well known, I was on the television. But it was a very frightening time, a very alarming time. Unemployment over 20%, you know. Great fears about where this conflict with Thatcherism would go, whether the city would go bankrupt, whether it would get taken over. And I think, you know, a lot of people in the early 80s, certainly the Conservative cabinet, thought, no future for this place.
No.
Close it down. And that's how it felt, and that's what people were feared about.
And, I mean, you've done loads of work looking at comparatively of different cities. Was that sort of experience and what was going on in Liverpool distinct from, I don't know, Manchester down the road or Sheffield or, you know, the GLC in London? I mean, there were different elements of that going, but was it distinct?
It was, because at one point in the campaign against Thatcherism, against the cuts in the early 80s, everybody was in the same boat: London, Sheffield, Manchester, Liverpool.
Yeah.
I think the other places realised they weren't going to beat Thatcher. And Liverpool had this exaggerated sense of its own significance and thought, well, we're bigger than them and we're bigger than her because we are the imperial city.
Yeah.
So the sense of its significance, self-delusion.
Yeah.
Also, its politics are very different. You know, it was never had a kind of Labour tradition. Casualism, sectarianism, uncertainty, and entryism meant that there was no stable kind of base. The social classes were different. It was a blue-collar city. And so it was easier to have this kind of confrontation with Thatcher without the unions pulling it back,
yeah,
without the middle classes pulling it back. And so it was different, not in the way it had thought, as a matter of fact. So it was much more febrile,
yeah,
much more excitable, and, as I say, much more prone to entryism.
Yes, and knock-on implications that you talk in the book around how then the business community, the nature and shape of the business community, very large branch plant type economy, no local commitment, you know, fewer entrepreneurs, smaller businesses, and actually the dislocation between public and private was pronounced.
No, absolutely. It's one of the cons of being a port city. It was controlled by a small number of very large externally controlled firms, all of whom were having a dreadful time in the 70s and 80s, none of whom could pay a lot of attention to the city, all of whom worrying about their own businesses, basically. So the big multinationals kind of disinvested. It hadn't had a very strong tradition of entrepreneurism, so there wasn't, unlike Birmingham, you know, a kind of a history of small firms and entrepreneurship. Primary occupation in the dock, that was relatively unskilled work. So the whole set of things were missing from the city. The local small indigenous private sector wasn't powerful and was disengaged. It left the city, it went to the posh suburbs, across the water in other local boroughs. So there was a kind of a vacuum, which the militant entered into. And it wasn't really till the city had almost gone over the brink of bankruptcy and been taken over, the private sector began to say, my God, we can't go on like this. We don't like this, and we have to play our part in it. So I think towards 86, 87, as the Labour Party strategy was broken, it became obvious to the private sector that it needed to play some kind of part, you know?
Mm.
And there was that period where the universities, the churches, some of the promotional agencies began to say, we have to help the city council to form a different strategy. So that, for me, was a time when we kind of got off the brink.
Mm.
And that was tremendously important politically and culturally and psychologically, even though the economic circumstances weren't that much changed. But that became the point at which Liverpool said, we have to stop being exceptional, we have to become normal.
Yeah.
And that's the next period.
Yeah. Well, and we'll come. Yes, and we'll come back to the players and the sort of priorities that weave themselves through those periods. So, but 1988 to 98, you frame it lovely in a sense. Liverpool becomes normal or begins to move towards normal. Just say a little bit about, you know, what that was and what that felt like, what that looked like.
Two things, really. The militant and their supporters are all thrown out, first of all by the Labour Party and then by the courts. It meant there was a new generation of Labour leaders elected to the council in 88 with a very different kind of philosophy. After a couple of years, a very old-style centre-right politician who'd been big in the Merseyside County Council was made leader, Harry Rimmer, and he had a very clear idea the city couldn't go on like that, the Labour Party couldn't go on like that. He said, we've got to show a better last lot. We've got to show we can't continue being ungovernable. We've got to show we can't continue to be inefficient. We've got to show we will work with government. We've got to show we'll work with the private sector. So he found himself a chief executive, a man called Peter Bounds, from a small town up north in Bolton. They set out to change the way the city council portrayed itself. And began to say, we want to work with government, we want to work with the private sector, we want to work in partnership. So that's a very important shift. And the decade 88 to 98 is, you know, a kind of an old-fashioned Labour saying, we've got to change the performance of the city. Yeah? Two or three things helped. Europe came in halfway through, helped enormously, and some of the Merseyside Development Corporation, which has been set up, its work began to pay off on the waterfront in the city centre. Mm. So gradually a sense of, you know, we can find a new economic rationale for the city, we can find a new way of behaving in relation to the private sector, we can try and reform the city. And that decade, even though they ran out of steam, I think was a very important signal saying to government, to the private sector, the past is behind us, we're not going back to that, we're going to become a different place. And that's the decade where it laid the foundations for its renaissance.
And during that period, Michael, I mean, how contested was, you know, this statement that, you know, the leader and the chief exec, well, we need to do more of this, we need to do less of that. I mean, it somewhat feels inevitable now when you look back and say, well, obviously that was the right call, but at the time, and was there huge, you know, contest around and disagreement between this shift?
Within the Labour Party, there was. I mean, it was still a divided Labour Party. You know, the right wing were in control.
Yeah.
But the left was still going on about, you know, not wishing to give up what the militant had done. So internally, it was contested. But I have to say, in the city, people, and many different kinds of people, had been frightened by what had gone on in the mid-80s. And so it was almost as well, we've got to change from that. The other thing was, of course, you know, the money was very different. There wasn't the money to pursue this sort of leftist strategy of constantly building public housing, all the rest of it. And so people realized the money had run out, politically it had run out. So in a way, it was easier to make the political change than one might have thought. That's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
I hadn't much thought about. But it was not as controversial across the city as it could have been. There weren't great fights about this. There were internal Labour Party toings and froings. But on the whole, everybody realised, you know, that strategy of the left had failed. They had a good case. They had a good case about austerity. But they lost that argument. They overplayed the hand. And I think a new generation said, we're not going back to that.
No. And it was a shift, as you say in the book, you said just a moment ago, about, you know, the recognition that creating conditions where the economy can solidify and stabilize first off, but then begin to grow, becomes much more central to a council and a local authority's perspective than maybe hitherto it had been, which had been much more around traditional public services of, you know, of various types.
No, absolutely right. I mean, there was, I think several things happened. The sense that, you know, the old economy, the port and all of that, was never going to employ as many people in future as it had in the past. Mm. So you could regret that, but you had to deal with it. Secondly, the realization it was as much about the city as the city council.
Yeah.
I think that's the really important shift.
Mm.
And then the book, what I talk about in the book, I think, is the remaking of different parts of the city in a kind of placemaking way. And I think this was the period when people realized the city center was a tremendous driver of the Liverpool economy, over which the local authority had quite a lot of control. You know, didn't have very much control over the private economy, but it could shape that. And you got a growing realization that actually the city centre itself could be an economic driver. because that's where the financial and business services were, that's where tourism was, that's where the health sector was, that's where the universities were. And so there's a gradual realization that not only do you have to put the politics behind, but you had to find a new economic rationale.
Yes. Yeah.
And Europe was very important in all of this because, A, it put a lot of money in, $1.5 billion, which is a lot. But it asked the question, what are you for? What are you going to do in future with this place? What are the, what's going to be the growth sector of the economy? What are you going to invest in? What are the infrastructure requirements? What are the skills requirements? So again, the debate through the late 80s into late 90s became a different kind of debate, actually, about the city's economy, about placemaking, and what you might do about it. And it becomes, you know, a very different argument. Yeah. It made the 80s look pretty old-fashioned.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, which you highlight perfectly in the book, and you see this at other places, you will have seen it, is the European funding is significant, as you've said, but it's the external perspective and focus that they bring, which challenges the, you know, the those that are inside the city, of the city, from the city. And you can see that quite significantly. And of course, the other important influence and outside interest that brings to bear pretty much the whole of this period, but certainly late 70s on, is Lord Heseltine himself, in a sense of his role as a champion for Liverpool, but actually a challenge to Liverpool itself. So is there something in that in terms of, you know, places being helped to change by those that are not of it?
A lot. I say that in the book, and I do say at the last bit that external forces were important. Mm. I don't want to make too much of that because I think we have learned. But it was the case that we're in such a deep hole, people couldn't see a way out. Mm. And it needed some other people to see where we were and to say, well, what about that? And yeah. I think you're quite right, you put your finger on it. European Objective 1 money, 1994 to 2006, 1.5 billion, asking what's your economic future? Not necessarily having all the answers,
no.
But forcing the place to look at itself. Michael Heseltine is very interesting. Someone, an external reviewer, said the book, it's hagiography about Michael Heseltine. I don't think that's the case. If you look at all the initiatives which actually changed Liverpool, from the Development Corporation in the mid-80s, which he developed, through City Challenge in 92 to 97, which fundamentally changed the city centre and became the basis of knowledge economy, through to city regions or elected mayors or whatever, all of the big ideas actually have come from him. And as a matter of fact, when Liverpool or Merseyside got Objective 1 funding from Europe, it not only had to persuade the Europe to give it the money, well, that was easy because we were below 75% of GDP, we actually had to persuade the British government to accept that a bit of the UK was worse than Sicily.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And actually, it was Heseltine who persuaded the Tory cabinet to say, yeah, give them money. So, yes, yes to Heseltine, yes to Europe, and yes to the, you know, the crucial role of external forces at key moments.
Yes.
I argue in the book that we learned, the city leaders learned and became more self-confident. I think what I've also said in the book is this sort of 15 years of economic decline, political confusion, paralysis, conflict have produced a kind of a culture of failure and a culture of cynicism and a culture of defeatism and a lack of confidence. And in a certain way, we had to rebuild that, change that culture and rebuild that. And I think that's what some of these external initiatives asked you to do. The nuts and bolts are perhaps less important than, you know, what are you for?
Yeah.
You know, and I think also we have gone beyond blaming others. And there's a recognition that, you know, some of this stuff were our own self-made problems.
You know? Yeah, quite. So we arrive at 1998. And the next period is 1998 to 2010, which obviously coincides with a Labour government, newly elected, which had quite an expansionist programme on the, you know, public services side for certain, and indeed, you know, certain aspects of regional development and all of the rest of it. But you contextualise that period about Liverpool aspiring to be a European city. So say a little bit about, you know, about what that period felt like and why Europe suddenly become, or not suddenly, but becomes more important as an idea as much as a reality.
Absolutely right. I mean, two things. New Labour take over in 97. Liverpool throws out the Labour Party in 98, as it always does. It always bucks a trend. So yes, you know, it's still hard to remember how attractive Tony Blair and the Labour seemed then, but public sector, investment, booming economy, private market begin to realise you can invest in cities again, opportunities there. And then the Liberal Democrats, you know, with the Mike Storey, now Lord Storey, who really had a, you know, very big idea about this culture of failure, the lack of ambition, and want to change it. And he and David Henshaw, so David, you know, was chief exec of the city, really decided to kind of get a grip on the city. They realized they had to improve the local authority performance because it was poor, and they did. But they realized they had to kind of reposition the city, looking to its kind of former imperial, global, external looking, and building upon Europe, because, you know, Objective 1, 94-2006, which kind of straddled their regime, hugely significant. They exploited when Labour set or created the idea of urban regeneration companies, which were, you know, a public idea but not very much public money, and realised, hang on, we've got a city centre beginning to take off, we've got a public sector investment, we've got a new Labour idea of, you know, a city centre agency, and they really used that to massively expand the city centre, to make huge investment in it. They went for European capital of culture, which at the time just seemed like a bit of something to go for, despite their own expectations, won it, and had 4 years to prepare for it. And despite our own expectations, it would be a terrible disaster, it turned into a huge success.
Yep.
So it meant in 2008, Liverpool had something to go for, had to deliver a very important international project to persuade external and internal people it could do it. Mm. It involved a huge amount of infrastructure, building the arena, building transport, providing hotels, a huge, huge effort. And over that 10 years, the place did physically change. Mm. You could see it happening. Mm. Previously, it had changed psychologically, it changed politically, it began to change economically. But this was a massive change to the city centre and waterfront city centre. And it has not gone back from that.
No.
And that's when people thought, we can do this. Capital culture, terribly important. Urban generation company, very important. And that's the basis of the belief now, you know, this place has a future.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And so we get to, so that's the through till 2010. Obviously, a change of government at the national level, 2010, on the back of quite a deep and severe recession, and then essentially you're looking through 2010 through to 2019, and this is about, you know, a period of austerity on the one hand, a slowing of investment for certain, but still continuation in, you know, in the right direction, I think. But just tell us a story about that period, 10 to 19.
I call it continue ambition, age of austerity. Again, as the national government changes, Liverpool again throws out the Liberal Democrats and brings in, you know, a Labour Council. I mean, I think three things are important about this. First, Liverpool is the first big city outside London to go for an elected mayor and to say, yeah, we want to continue on this developmental path. You know, so I think that's an important thing. Mm. Secondly, austerity has hit Liverpool badly. I know every big city and every probably small town will say we've been badly hit. I think the evidence is, I think your report showed, that Liverpool has been hit worst. And so there's been a tremendous effort to continue the development path, going for prestige projects, but avoiding the politics of confrontation of the 80s. Despite the fact, in my judgment, the financial problems of the city are now greater than they were in the 80s. So I think the Labour Council, particularly the Labour Mayor, elected Mayor Johnson, has done a very good job of trying to cope with austerity, trying to cope with the cuts, making clear it wasn't his choice, it was, you know, first the coalition and the Tory government, but trying to keep the private sector on board and saying, you know, the city's not a basket case, it's going. I think we were lucky in the sense that the crisis 2008-2010 hit after many of the big prestige projects were completed. If it had been 5 years earlier, I think we'd have been stuck with a lot of stuff half-done.
Yeah.
So it meant that I think in this period of austerity, we haven't slipped back as far as we used to do. Now, the old story of Liverpool is you come up in a boom and you fall back in a bust. Of course, it hasn't been the same, but I think it hasn't fallen back down the hill. There is still a lot of private sector investment going into Liverpool in development, and frankly, there are buildings flying up all across the city centre. So the private sector realised there is still value in Liverpool, and that development continues. Yeah. I think also we've begun to capitalise and recognise that if the 80s was about public housing and the public sector, and the 90s and the early noughties was about residential, retail, leisure, I think we've now begun to realise you need a, you know, more substantial bits of your economy to build upon. So I think we're now going on to the knowledge economy, the universities, the health economy, advanced manufacturing, visitor economy is booming. So I think we've now got some key sectors which we clearly are growing, and we've got some development taking place. So the leadership has handled it, I think, very well. That said, I think there are real risks involved, quite frankly. The scale of the fiscal crisis is big, and the impact that will have on particular places and particular people, I think, are some of the challenges to come.
Yeah, and just coming on. No, quite absolutely. And what was it that in that period that, for example, that, you know, the city was the first to say, we are going to take, you know, we want to be and have a mayor of the city, where, as you say, they were the first to do it out of the big cities, did it voluntarily, in fact, before, you know, before others even had undertaken their referendum. They were also in the first wave and very enthusiastic further down the line for, you know, for city region mayor, and obviously you know, that's been ongoing over the last couple of years. What was it? How would you explain that, Michael?
Actually, I think a lot of this is to do with the personality and character and politics of Mayor Joe Anderson, who was elected leader, because he'd been a councillor for a long time, and he has ambitions, and he recognised that the elected mayor model gave them opportunity to get into bed with government, because in fact we had an elected mayor without a referendum.
Yeah.
Obviously the city's had a referendum and lost.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Anderson realised if he could get that job, he could make a difference to the city, he could continue to get investment, and he could continue to work with government. So I think he realised that was important. He also realised, and I think when Liverpool got the elected city mayor, he really wanted to have a city regional mayor, but he found the local authorities weren't up for it. So he said, okay, we'll do a deal with government, and you know, we'll have an elected mayor of the city, and we'll get resources for that, and they have. 3 or 4 years later, when government says, oh, now we want city regional mayors, we already have a city mayor, and now we have an elected city regional mayor.
Yes.
Liverpool has paid a price of being well behaved.
Yes.
Having a city mayor early on. But I think, again, the wider story is that people realised, yeah, the city's important, but it's too small. Obviously, it's difficult to mention the M word in Liverpool, Manchester, but everybody knows that Manchester had been ploughing the city regional furrow for quite a long time, and it's kind of obvious they were getting a lot of benefits out of that. So I think it made sense to the political leadership. Yeah, it's the right thing to do economically. It's the right thing to do politically.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So we'll look to the future for a second, and I want to come back to just pick up some of the aspects of the story in terms of, you know, things like the renaissance of Albert Dock, the city centre, the focus on speak, and because I think that tells a little bit about what next. But just for those listening and for our listeners, just give us a sort of scorecard of Liverpool, you know, today. When you kind of look back over that period, and you said right at the beginning, you know, progress has been made. You know, there is always a long way to go in many respects. But just paint a picture of Liverpool today as we see it.
It's incredible changes which have occurred in Liverpool in the past 33 years. It's also important to realise that many of those changes were essentially physical changes, and many of them were really about the city centre, about the waterfront of the city centre. So I think a huge transformation in the place physically, a huge transformation in the place politically, I think a huge transformation psychologically and culturally. It looks and feels a different place now than then. So that's all very good news. I think there have been some significant economic changes. I talk in the book about the key drivers and show actually it has done very well on some of those key drivers. But I also show it has a long way to go on some of those key drivers. I show it has come a very long way, but so have others. I show that it has performed well, but its economy is not as big as Manchester or Leeds. You know, it shows that we're still 17,000 firms short. It shows we're still not doing well enough on skills. It shows we're not as well connected as we ought to be. But I would say that huge progress on what could be done on the city centre. And in retrospect, it was the right thing to do because the city centre is a significant driver. So there's no point challenging that policy because it has worked. And, you know, as you walk around the city now, you see, you hear the voices. You never heard foreign voices in the past. You look at the waterfront, you look at the hotels, you look at the restaurants, you look at the foreign visitors. Huge amount going on. That's all brilliant. Economically, we have some big challenges ahead. And socially, we have some huge challenges. Because I could recite all the problems about skills, unemployment, poverty, poor health. They all remain. Not necessarily worse than some other big cities in the north we could mention, but they're very large challenges. And so I think we can congratulate the city, ourselves, its leadership, on its achievements over three decades. But they all know, and we all know, there is a lot more to do at a time when fiscal stress is beginning to bite. So it seems to me we're now optimistic, confident, but realistic about scale of achievement, but also scale of challenge.
And when you think about that arc of over that time, Michael, and the bits that you talk about and the way that at different points, you know, they were conceived as part of the jigsaw, I suppose, of how you both stabilize city, but then, you know, the place and then make it ultimately more successful. You know, you kind of hear this, I mean, you hear it as well, you know, this sort of criticism of, you know, the kind of way of thinking about cities and how they evolve. You know, we miss the point, you know, people don't locally benefit. I mean, is there a degree that this is the way that, you know, in a sense you have to do, you know, physical transformation, physical stabilization? It's only that before, you can't do that. Well, if you don't do that, you can't do the other things. And there is an inevitable sequence into these sorts of things. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, partly, you know, you asked what Liverpool was like 30 years ago. It was broken economically, socially, and physically.
Yeah.
I mean, it showed very badly. And so if you're going to be a modern city, if you're going to be a successful city, you've got to fix the place.
Yeah.
That's why I call the book grid, it's about economic placemaking.
Yeah.
And I talk about four or five big initiatives. First, the waterfront with the MDC, then the city centre with City Challenge, then Speak Garston, which is the area where the advanced manufacturing, chemicals, and airport are, and then the knowledge economy. And I say we have, in effect, fixed, not completely, but certainly fixed, four or five big chunks of the city which have economic potential. It's not just doing the buildings. It's they have an economic purpose.
Yeah? Yeah.
And it goes back to that sense of, well, what can we do? I mean, things are so bad, what can we do? Well, let's do some things. Let's fix some bits and try to connect them. So it's kind of a jigsaw.
Yeah.
And I think that was necessary. Is sufficient? No, but it was absolutely necessary to do that. And partly you have to build internal confidence. Look what we've achieved in the city centre. Partly you have to show to external investors this place works. Partly you have to show government you can trust us to do these things. So you're reconstructing and remaking, yeah, this post-imperial city. Mm. Yeah. I used to say in the old days about Liverpool, you can redistribute wealth. You really can't redistribute poverty. And that's what it was like 30 years ago. You have to somehow get out of that. I'm not talking about trickle down, but I do think you need to create some economic activity which has real value.
Yeah.
And then you can ask the question, well, where are we going to distribute that, as it were? And what do people and places' role have in that? So I think that's what we have done. I think there are two or three questions lurking. One, we know that we have been very, very good at physical regeneration. We know that, and it shows. I'm saying that won't be enough in the decades to come. We've got to get on to economic competitiveness.
Yep.
So I think we need a different economic strategy in future. And we also know, the question that's implied, that in that physical regeneration, there are lots of places and lots of people who haven't shared. And we know, in a sense, we have to improve the economy in future, but also ask the question, well, you know, who is the city for?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think those are the questions we ask in future. What kind of place do we want to, how productive we want to be, and what are we going to do for all the people?
Yeah.
They seem to me the existential philosophical political questions we now face.
Yeah, and quite, and you know, you talk a lot in the book, particularly towards the end when you're reflecting on the progress, but also the issues to come. You know, the next big challenge, I suppose, big opportunities around the knowledge quarter, the expansion of university and education, Baltic Triangle, those sorts of issues as kind of big opportunities. But the big challenge, as you say in the book, is around, you know, North Liverpool particularly, but not exclusively, in and around Anfield and that kind of area. I suppose in part, you know, my thing, and maybe it's too simplistic, you can only address the problems and challenges of Anfield and North Liverpool if you've gone through the process of dealing with pretty much other parts of the country. You know, I don't understand. I always struggle to think about how you could do it the other way around. And I people often say to me, no, you should be doing, you know, should be helping Anfield first. My response is help them with what and how, given the context of the overall city often, which is struggling. And as you say, it was on its knees, if not worse than that. I don't know, what's your thought on that?
Well, this is interesting, because I think the best bit of the book is the last bit of the book. And it was the bit I never wrote until someone said to me, well, this history, Michael, is very nice and it's true, but you're not really posing the question, well, what have we got to do next? Mm. You've told the tale of how we got from there to there, and that's well told and necessary, but it isn't sufficient. And it was only on thinking about my conversation with friends and things you hear in the pub or on the bus, you know, what are the issues? And I ended up, I think, almost the best bit of the book is the conversation about North Liverpool. Mm. And I wrote it after someone had said, well, you talked about how we fixed South Liverpool. You don't say anything about North Liverpool. And I said, because I don't know very much about it. And I thought, well, that can't be right.
Yeah.
I'm writing the book about the city, and I'm saying I don't know enough about that bit.
Yeah.
Which led me into conversation with people who do know about it and have worked there, who said, yeah, it's the lost part, as it were. It was the most successful part of the imperial economy, it was all around the port.
Mm.
But then when the port went into decline, it went into decline, etc., etc. And so I suddenly realized that this was something we had to address as a city. It's not been controversial, but it's the bit that people have sometimes taken exception to, because it is hard-hitting, and I do call it a stain on the city's conscience, actually.
Mm.
And I tried to ask, not what, but why? Because the what is obvious. You know, the figures are much worse for that part of the city than for the rest of the city, and obviously for the rest of the nation.
Yep.
Okay? So that's obvious, and we all know that. When you, whatever you take, employment, crime, health, poverty, education, the figures are worse there.
Mm.
The question is, why have we not done more about it? If we could fix the city centre, we could fix South Liverpool, why not? And I say, as you might say, well, let's start the bits we can do. You know, let's start with some of the bits which have potential, yeah? But I think there are other things that led us to neglect it. I don't think there were always votes in it. They were taken for granted by Labour.
Mm.
It was not Liberal Democratic territory, mm. so in a sense, it never had resonance.
Mm.
It was more difficult. South Liverpool was difficult, but it had a lot of assets. It had an airport, it had anchor institutions, so you could see the potential there. North Liverpool, the port had gone, food processing had gone, no big anchor institutions save the football clubs, no big universities, no big hospitals. And so I think this has really struck a chord in the city because we've done the city centre and we've got more to do, but that's done. South Liverpool will look after itself. Near North Liverpool will now work because the Peel development's taking place. There's a strategy for 10 streets. There's already quite a lot of investment gone into some of the docks. Everton Football Club, I think almost certainly will build a big stadium at that end. And so suddenly realize we're now rebuilding this bit, and it's critical, not to say we should have done more then, but now it is absolutely critical that you can't have development in that part of the city and have those figures untouched.
No.
And so I'm saying all of us, the city council, Peel, the universities, the hospitals, the football clubs, and the academies have got to say, we cannot find in 10 years' time there's been development in near North Liverpool which has not helped that part. And that's, people have said, my God, yes, that's so obvious. It's so simple, but it's so true.
So true.
You know?
Mm.
And I'm rather proud of that, actually,
yeah.
to be honest.
Yeah.
Although I'm now stuck with trying to lead on it, you know, from the university's end. But it seems to me, and this I say to the mayor, who says, Michael, we've done more than you admit. And I say, you have done a lot. But there's a map in my book. Two maps. One says, is there a big gap within Liverpool? Yes, there is, between North and the rest. But the second map says, what happened to that gap in the last 10 years? And the gap got bigger.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, people knew there was a gap. I didn't know, or I hadn't shown that. And I think that second map is incredibly powerful.
Yes.
Because no matter what we've done, whatever initiatives, the fact is they haven't really had the impact. So for me, that's the key message of
yeah.
the book.
Yeah, and it's a great reminder. I mean, you illustrate in that section, and it's not a comment on the institution, you know, but the literal proximity of Anfield and Everton to very, very poor, difficult neighbourhoods, in a sense, just reminds us that growth is important, you know, wealth is important, but if you don't do something deliberate and particular with communities, even if they literally live next door to these things, there is no inevitability that they will get better as a result of it.
Oh, absolutely right. And, you know, that's, you know, the floor of trickle-down economics, okay, which
indeed,
is all very well
indeed.
Known. We know all that.
Yeah.
And I think this is the chance and the opportunity. I would say about Liverpool in particular,
yeah.
that the two football clubs historically haven't seen their commitment and have really not done enough. It has to be said, I'm a red, but the blue club, Everton, have done a huge amount over 10 years
yeah.
in the community. And I think it's absolutely right to say that Liverpool Football Club, with the new leadership, both external owners and the chief executive, recognise they have not done enough, and they themselves are now trying to match Everton. So I think both the anchor institutions now realise they're going to be more and more successful globally And the question will always be asked, but what are you surrounded by?
Yeah.
And I think it's very much on their agenda,
yeah.
Which is why I have a bit of optimism and confidence, actually, about being able to make, you know, a difference. Because if you get those two global organizations saying, yeah, we're committed, we're here, we're taking it seriously, you can say, well, you know, they're big institutions and we can do things. And I actually think if you took the back of the envelope now and said, in 20 years' time, what would that part of the city look like? What would we be doing there? If you take the European Commission's approach to North Liverpool that they took to Liverpool itself, what are you for? What will you do? What will it take? What will be the infrastructure needs? What are the skill requirements? Who would do what? What level of resources? What kinds of initiatives? And map that out. I think you could really change that place. And I think if you take an asset-based approach and say, well, what don't you have, but what do you have with the local authority, appeal, football clubs, university, hospitals, I think you can turn it around. It seems to me, I want the message about North Liverpool to be a kind of a positive one.
Yes.
Rather than, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. Just turn a little bit around, you know, I suppose the lessons of Liverpool for other cities, and then what do the lessons of Liverpool tell us for urban policy more generally? So just give us a sense of, you know, your reflections on, you know, Liverpool's history over this experience over this period, what it tells us about other cities.
Yeah, it's a so what question, isn't it? Is it just a book about Liverpool, which, you know, you're interested in, Michael, you live there, and so are the Scousers, but so what?
Yeah.
I think it's very important. It's sui generis in particular, it's exceptional, but I think it speaks to a lot of important issues. I say for other places, at home and abroad, if you realize how bad it was and how much we've achieved, it shows you can always make changes. So in a way, it says, don't be pessimistic. Try and see what your path out is. And I get a lot of people coming from, you know, across the globe, actually, in Korea and Japan and, you know, lots of Europe say, well, how did it happen? And I say, well, we are different, but these are the things we did. This is how it worked. These are some of the principles. And it shows to me that you can do it. These are very unpromising circumstances. And if we can do it, you can do it. And, you know, Barnsley and Stoke and Blackburn are different kinds of places, different scale. But I think you can see, well, you know, there are some principles there. So I think for other places, the message is it can be done. It ain't quick, it ain't easy, but it can be done. Yeah. For Liverpool itself and the Scousers, I say, look, the message is, you know, the culture of failure and defeatism and cynicism didn't work. The thing about ambition and confidence and optimism does work. Let's not go back. Let's try these virtues we now have, I think, will keep us going in future. There are two other audiences for the book. One I haven't thought about very much, but then very senior people said to me, Liverpool still has a perception image problem. And even now, the investor class in London still doesn't know what has happened or isn't listening or hasn't been told. And part of the book is to say, look, is it perfect? No. Is it being remade? Yes. Is there opportunity there? Could you invest there? So my message to the investor class is, you know, come and take a look, see what we've done, and there's value. Yeah. The final point is really to government, because the key message, I think, it'll become fashionable again. It's currently unfashionable. If you look at all the things which changed Liverpool in those three decades, which I cite in great detail in the book, and you want to hear it now, a very high proportion, if not all of them, were public sector initiated or led or funded. Whether it was the Merseyside Development Corporation with Michael Heseltine, whether it was City Challenge with Heseltine, whether it was the European Objective One program, whether it was Speak Garson, SDP, and on the task force, the public sector played a very significant role at key moments. Yeah, and it paved the way for private sector investment and all the rest of it. So I think Liverpool, when its biggest problems occurred, when frankly Thatcher withdrew money in the 80s, and it exaggerated our problems. You know, when New Labour was investing, I mean, wisely or unwisely, wisely in my view, Liverpool had a boom. And I have to say, as government has disinvested from cities, Liverpool has paid a price. Mm. We have gone backwards in that. We have lost ground.
Yeah.
So it seems to me there is a message to government about, you know, the role of the public sector, the role of the state with the private sector, the need for intervention in the right kind of way, and basically about investment. And this is really what I think it's all about.
Yes.
You know, when you invest, you get a return.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one big message, that public sector intervention in the right way, and I specify in the book what are the conditions for success, what kind of initiatives work. So, you know, I say all that's not just a question of chucking money at it, but the public sector having a very, very significant role is very important. And, you know, I refer to work I've done on Europe, which makes the point about the role of the state in advanced successful economies, whether it's Germany or whether it's Finland, basically. I think there's another big message, which is we started on this. We are, I think, running the risk of taking all the achievements of not just Liverpool, but all the big cities, taking it for granted, or assuming the job has been done. And in these Brexit or pre-Brexit or post-Brexit days, turning to a different story about the small towns.
Yeah.
And for me, this is, in a sense, a false dichotomy. I think the big cities have all got a long way to go. And if you disinvest now, you lose investment you've had. I don't think it's a question of the big cities versus small towns, because, in fact, I think the small towns need to feed off, and they both matter. As everyone says, this is a regional thing. Small towns in the south are very successful. Not size that matters, it's location that matters. And so I think it's very, very important that we don't now begin a narrative of divide and rule between the cities and the small towns in the north.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real risk of that, quite frankly, even more at the current time. So I think it's very important that we keep the urban agenda and the urban lobby together and not allow divide and rule.
Yeah, and stepping, I mean, you've done an awful lot of work on European cities. I mean, did Lords on Global, but particularly European cities, led the Institute at the University for an awful lot, long time looking at these sorts of questions. I suppose just kind of finish your reflections on, do we have a peculiarly British, is there a peculiarly British way of thinking about cities, which is distinct from how the French think about them, or the Germans, or the, you know, or the Dutch, or the, you know, so on and so on. I mean, you know, how is Liverpool, is the equivalent in Germany, regarded by national government? Because you're right, in a sense, it waxes and wanes, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, the attitude that national government has of a big place, economically, socially, politically, culturally, like Liverpool. I always felt slightly strange to me. I don't know, what is it, are we a peculiar way of thinking about urban and cities in this country?
Yeah, when we used to do Urban Studies 101, we would teach the kids that there is a kind of anti-urban bias in the UK. When the industrial class, 19th century, got rich, they cleared off the countryside and built their piles. So there is a kind of, I think, still a kind of anti-urban thing. Yeah, don't want to exaggerate, but I think there is. I think, you know, many European countries have a slightly more rational view about what the role of the cities are, quite frankly. They've certainly, I think, realised the need to invest in more long term. Yeah, not all of them, but I think there is, you know, the work we did for different European Commission and S1 projects showed there is a recognition about cities driving national economies. And if you look at what, you know, the French have done, if you look at what the Germans have done, look what, you know, the Finns have done, and there is a realisation that you need to get them to work. We are ambivalent about them, I think. And then there's the other point we haven't laboured and we haven't even discussed, which is, you know, this country is dominated by, you know, one big city, you know. And I've argued that the evidence is, and I think it's true, that countries which have more successful cities have higher performing economies, quite frankly. And I know London, the goose that lays the golden eggs, we don't want to kill the goose. But I just think that if we have, you know, a better balance, more decentralised, more high-performing cities across the country, it would be better for UK PLC. I've always thought that. I still think that, you know, our big urban centres, how well they've done, are still dragging our economy down rather than dragging it up. And it just seems that's the key message. If you want a successful economy, you have to recognise where economic value is and economic activity is. You have to invest in it, and you have to spread it around a bit more, quite frankly. This is not an anti-London argument at all. But you do have to think, well, where are we going to invest, and what kind of story do we have about the economic placemaking narrative for the country? And it seems to me you will have to go back to that. We're being driven back to it because of the Brexit left behind argument, but I think that's the wrong point of entry. Mm. I think it is, you know, not to play off those places against apparently more successful places. It's to say, well, what does that mean to the kind of economy we've created and want to create? And then I think place and economic placemaking, which is the thread of that book, becomes, you know, the message.
My guest today has been Michael Parkinson. Michael, thanks for being part of City Talks.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.